Paul Marcelin Sampson of the Metro Writers Union, Jane Kaiser of Psychiatric Inmates Rights Collective, John Stewart, similarly. And we've got all kinds of call-ins planned, updates on CPS's seizure of Stacy and Orly Jones Ford homeless children who aren't homeless, but apparently living in a vehicle is not good enough. The De Anza trailer sellout. Not the trailers, they're mobile homes, but hey, they're getting sold out next Tuesday at City Council. So stay with us for an action-packed, at least hopefully a information-packed show. The action, of course, is up to you.
I ain't an outlaw, I ain't no thief. My spirit's willing, but these habits, they run deep. I ain't the bad guy, I didn't shoot anyone. But you got me running like the last Bar West outlaw. You got me hiding in the shadows. Been a long, long time since I've seen the sun. I ride by night like an outlaw. Wanted dead or alive for having too much fun. Yeah, yeah. Try to make a living, but your work day never stops. It's a trail well ridden, never takes you to the top. I don't want to change things, just the right to choose. But you got me singing those desperado blues. You got me hiding in the shadows. Long, long time since I've seen the sun. I ride by night like an outlaw. Wanted dead or alive for having too much fun. Yeah, yeah, wanted dead or alive for having too much fun. Questions why? Yeah, even here in Santa Cruz, the city of love and peace, I'm getting busted by the local police for playing in the streets. That's right. You got me hiding in the shadows. Been a long, long time since I've seen the sun. I ride by night like an outlaw. Wanted dead or alive for having too much fun. Yeah, yeah, wanted dead or alive for having too much fun. Like an outlaw, singing desperado blues.
And welcome from the local Desperados here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Robert Norse, and we got, as I mentioned before, studio guests galore on this September 21st, I guess we're at, Sunday morning. It's about 9:35 or a little bit thereafter, and starting a little bit late, but not that late. Hopefully you're going to stay with us, or at least stay with us for part of the show. Lots of subjects, and the first two we're going to be covering are a lot of updates and a preparation, as well as a sort of a broader orientation around the upcoming show on Sunday. But first, let's the show on Sunday, next Sunday, is going to be regarding, we're going to do a long and I hope productive interview with the author of Mad in America, Bad Science, Bad Medicine, and the Enduring Mistreatment of the Mentally Ill, a book written last year by Robert Whittaker, who is not a psychiatrist, not even a former psychiatric survivor, or a psychiatric survivor, but just simply a reporter, a writer for the Boston Globe, who just was bowled over by figures from the World Health Organization that showed people in third world countries actually recover three times as much and stay, quote, well longer from, quote, schizophrenic disorders than those in the developed countries, such as Western Europe, the United States, Russia. And he found the common denominator, the missing link, the smoking gun, the key, was the forced medication or the pressured medication use of psychotropic drugs. And he also did, of course, a very extensive analysis of the history of the different kinds of so-called therapies that have been used throughout the last 250, 300 years here in the United States and the colonies before that. Very interesting book, and I was able to secure his consent to come on the show, and we're going to have some local folks interviewing him. But even more important than that is, of course, the local scene, and we're going to be talking about that. But since I introduced him first, and since he's waiting patiently in the shadows here, the cool of the day before we all begin to get fried out in the studio as the day heats up, looks like we're having the last of a hot summer, is Paul Marcelin Sampson, who you may remember from last week. Paul has been working for months, actually for a year or more, on making Metro Transit more accessible, more rational, more egalitarian. Is that fair to say, Paul?
Yes, especially the egalitarian part. Thank you.
Sure. And, yeah, I mean, I know you came here last week. You showed us your newsletter that you wanted to distribute at the Santa Cruz and Watsonville Metro Centers, but when you asked for the proper procedures so that you wouldn't step on any toes, you were told that you would just sort of have to wait for the proper time when they had their policies in place. Am I putting that properly?
We are forcing them to produce a policy. There was none in place before, other than the harassment of people who were attempting to conduct free speech activities.
Now, were you actually personally harassed? Remind me of yourself. Had you been out there distributing, or someone you know distributing, and you found that they were interfered with by police authorities or by Metro bureaucrats or by officials of some kind?
No, I declined to take the risk of
guinea pig. Not you.
I wanted to, I suppose, force the district to make clear its policies, and hopefully we will wind up with a clear set of rules, and people will not be harassed in the future.
And of course, my feeling, as I told you, was that we already have a clear set of rules, the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. I think the California Constitution has a similar provision, providing Congress shall make no law prohibiting respecting free speech, the right of the people peaceably to assemble, to petition the government for redress of their grievances. I always stumble a bit over that, but it's pretty brief, pretty pungent, and pretty much to the point, no law, and Congress in this case has been expanded to mean legislative authorities at the state and local level and bureaucratic administrations connected with the government. So my thought, of course, has always been you can always walk into the Metro and distribute, and if they start messing with you, you mess back and you point out, here's my law. My concern about policies has been that they will come up with protest pens that are teeny tiny areas or more limited areas than would naturally be the case. That, of course, was a concern I expressed to you. I know it also has interfered, the fact that you felt discouraged or repressed or constrained, if I'm putting this properly, from proceeding to distribute the literature that you wrote, a rather, what, 7 or 8 or 10 page newsletter?
Yeah, it was an 8 page bilingual newsletter, first 4 pages in English and then everything also in Spanish for the second set of pages.
Mm-hmm. You actually wrote this back in June and we're planning to distribute it then?
Yes, my partner and I wrote it in June, and we did a preliminary translation ourselves also and enlisted some help from a community member.
So from June to September, late September, essentially the policies, lack of policies, general attitude of the Metro authorities has stopped the public from receiving this publication at the Metro Center because you have not felt comfortable giving it out. Is that accurate?
Yes, it is.
So what we have here, folks, is another example to me, and this is not Paul speaking, this is Robert, the host here. Repression by the city authorities, some of it simply kind of a power deal where they feel like they should, you know, control what goes on, but some of it having to do with a targeted repression against activists whose message they don't like. And I don't think they're talking about you, Paul, or maybe they are, because you've been also in the news for trying to get established bureaucratic committees that you've been critical of and you've worked on but not been too successful with regarding the Metro to open up, to have more accessibility. You didn't talk about that much last time. Maybe a little bit of background of your political background in working with the Metro might be helpful for folks to understand, because that, I'm guessing, that may also be a factor in slowing down, and they're not allowing you to go out there and say, hey, you know, we're working on these policies, but while we are, just go out there, distribute what you need to, and don't get in people's way, and don't get in people's face, and don't hassle them, but otherwise, First Amendment applies. I mean, it seems to me that's the most obvious policy they could use, but they aren't doing that, right?
Yeah, and I think that they are concerned about the message that the Writers Union is trying to put out. It is a very direct and specific message, and we focus on, let's say, certain sacred cows at Metro, certain policies and decisions that work against equity. So there is some concern about our message. For me, nothing is sacred, and my focus is on doing research, economic research, and getting to the bottom of the fare system, how service is allocated around the county, making sure that everybody has a fair share. And Metro doesn't like that. I'm the first person, I think, to ask some of these tough questions in this district.
Give us a few of those tough questions, Paul. You may have mentioned a few last week, I think you have, but review those and also tell us a couple of the others that you think are maybe rocking the corridors of the Metro, or at least making some of them a little nervous.
Okay, well, the first thing I'll look at that's most accessible to people is the fares that we pay when we ride the bus. And we'll talk about the fares that were charged for the last 10 years. Obviously, we have a new fare that began this summer, $1.50, but we have more data about the history and the old $1 fare. Would you say it's fair for some people to be paying $1 to ride the bus and others to be paying 40 cents or perhaps 55 cents? And would you say that's fair if the people who are paying $1 earn less and are in a more difficult economic situation than those who are paying the 40 cents or the 55 cents?
Fair, fair. So that was one of the questions. If you're asking me, a man who rides the bus far less than he should, I used to ride the bus a lot more. I would have to say I was distracted while you asked the question. Can you summarize it again, please?
Certainly. Would you say it is fair for some people to be paying $1 to ride the bus and others to be paying 40 or 55 cents when the folks who are paying the $1, the higher fare, are poorer and having a harder time of it economically?
I remember you mentioned the fact that, that those who put in a large lump sum, kind of like the large corporations get the big deal, the big buyers get the big deal, the people who buy the longer range passes get the big deal, and often those are the people who can afford to put together that clump of money at the beginning of the month. Is that what that was at the
exactly
point? Yeah. No, it ain't fair, and you were bringing up, apparently they decided there'd be a little more unfair and stop you from even communicating that message or make it more difficult for you to do so.
Yes, and they've I suppose you could say turned the fare structure upside down and increased the inequity. Those who have a lot of cash are able to purchase a heavily discounted monthly pass. The discount on the monthly pass has increased with the new fare structure, and the punitive amount that the cash poor folks who put in $1 every or now $1.50 every time they ride the bus pay has gone up.
Well, in all fairness, since we're speaking of fair fares, what's the situation in other transit districts? Do they have a similar disparity? Have you investigated that, or is this something that Santa Cruz is sort of shares with with other metro transit areas?
On the surface, Santa Cruz shares it with a lot of other American transit systems. It's not so common in Canada, and it's not so common in Europe. But there is some movement happening right here in California, and specifically in Northern California. For example, AC Transit, which serves the eastern portion of the San Francisco Bay, it's the third largest bus system in California, has taken steps recently to resolve some of these inequities. They are raising their monthly pass prices and holding the line on their cash fares, and it's a very bold step. They actually came close to proposing doing away with all passes so that everyone would pay the same fare to ride the bus. And so they're taking steps in that direction. Also, Los Angeles Metro, which is obviously the biggest transit agency in the state.
And one of the worst, as I remember.
Yes, you could say that. But even they are onto the inequities of monthly passes. They've had press releases and been in the newspaper in Los Angeles explaining that people who buy those passes are getting a free ride at the expense of those who are cash poor and have to put a dollar, in their case it's $1.35, in the fare box.
Well, that's one of the issues. Other issues that you've raised in the last year that you think are important for us, the public, to know about, and they also may have made you a target, or let us say made them less than excited about giving you about more. They made them more interested in interfering with your free speech right to be distributing literature at the metro centers on those issues.
Other chief issue, and again, this is very visible to those of us who ride the bus every day, is crowding and how we allocate buses around the system. You'll find if you ride between Watsonville and Santa Cruz, or if you ride to UCSC, that your buses are the most crowded in the system. UCSC in particular has loads of perhaps 70 passengers an hour. Those buses are full. People are being turned away at the bus stops. And I should point out also that UCSC students pay more or less full price. They're not receiving much of a break when you actually look at the way their contract is structured. It's a misconception that they get a significant discount. And the same thing happens with folks who are traveling to and from Watsonville. Their buses are very crowded, and you might see 40, 50 passengers per hour on those lines. Meanwhile, if you go to other parts of the county, particularly the suburban areas and the semi-rural areas in the county, you've got empty buses. We still have bus lines that accommodate perhaps 4 people per hour. And you're paying the same fare to get in the door. In one case, you're getting $5 of subsidy from the public, and in another case, you're getting a subsidy of a few cents.
So what's been happening in the last week? You gave us an update on this last week, and an exposition of this, and you were hoping to meet with the Metro Transit folks, and you have a meeting coming up at the board, which the public can come to at the Santa Cruz City Council meeting next Friday, I believe it is.
Oh, this is the Metro board meeting. This is a regular public board meeting. There are two every month, and the district's proposed policy on free speech, the time, manner, and place rules. In other words, how to have free speech without hopefully interfering with smooth operation of the transit center, hopefully without interfering too much with the free speech also. But this policy will be up for discussion next Friday, the 26th of September at 9 a.m. at Santa Cruz City Council Chambers. It's a Metro board meeting.
And that's 9 a.m. on Friday. And there's the oral communication is usually at the beginning or at the end of the session, or is there? There is an oral communication.
Yes, there is. They're required, thankfully, under the Brown Act. I'm sure they wouldn't bother if they weren't required. But there are two opportunities for oral communication. You can make general points that don't relate to the agenda. Right at 9 o'clock, if you come in, you have up to 3 minutes to speak. And we always really like to hear from riders. You never see bus riders in the room. There are two board members who ride the bus in special circumstances, one being both being disabled riders. But we never see commuters. We never see university students. We never see the Cabrillo College students who recently got hit with their bus passes. So we really want to see ordinary bus riders come out there and make general comments at 9 a.m. And then for things that are on the agenda, such as this free speech issue, you also have an opportunity after the staff presents its report. You get another 3 minutes and you can talk about that specific issue.
And of course, we're talking about Rotkin and a couple of council members, a couple of supervisors, and then some other folks from Watsonville. And
yeah, and there are actually three community members on the board as well.
Are they very community-minded in your view?
No, they're mostly developers, lawyers. They're from the upper echelons of the economic structure in this community.
Come. Now, wait a minute. This is a progressive community. We wouldn't have that kind of thing here in Santa Cruz. It would only be the people, the basic people, who would be represented. Corporations would be serving the community. That's certainly what's happening here.
Yeah. No, we would expect that it would be progressive, and it really isn't. It's also funny that the two bus riders who are on the board, it's very unusual to have bus riders on a transit district board. You never see that anywhere in North America. We do have them, and one of the two people is completely silent. She hasn't made a comment in months. All I can say is that a dedicated bus rider serving on that board would have something to say every day.
Wow. So 9 o'clock on Friday morning, Santa Cruz City Council chambers, if you want to discuss this. Paul, you'll be there, presumably, so people can know who you are. You have some sort of wire-rimmed glasses, your short hair, your neatly trimmed mustache, and a very nice goatee, unlike the sloppy hair on some of us. And you're a somewhat darker skin. Racist, take note. You'll be there a little early, maybe, to talk to people who want to come to this meeting?
Certainly, I'll be there early, and I'll be there afterwards, too. These are long meetings. They can go on to up to 3 hours, but usually the best opportunity to talk is afterwards for those who can wait, but I'll be there early and also at the end. And you can recognize me by the groans from the board member when I step up to the podium, from the board members when I step up to the podium.
You also... I had a thought here a moment ago. Let's see. Oh yeah, your website. You recently simplified the access to your website, and you've got some stuff there. What is that website again?
I wanted, first of all, to thank you for prompting me to take action there. I guess I was a little timid about the website, and when I read out the location, I realized it was too long. Thank you for prompting me to take action there. You're directly responsible for this. Now it is metroridersunion.org. Very simple. Just type metroridersunion.org in your browser. You don't have to type www. Or HTTP, anything like that. Metroridersunion.org.
Metroridersunion.org.
We're also working on a parallel project, which is a more personal project. I've been working on a transit guide for some time to help people live without a car in this county, to find out how you get to the store, how you get to places, how you get to the Giants game, how you do day-to-day activities on transit. And I've decided to put that on the web, and the location of that is iridethebus.org. It is not ready yet. You're welcome to take a look at the first page, but the pictures and travelogues are not there yet. We're working on them over the next few days. The site is fully accessible. It's one of the first transit websites in the country to be fully accessible to people with disabilities. It is compatible with text-only, web software, speech readers, and other devices. So we really want to open this up, and we also welcome your suggestions about places where you want to go on transit. So iridethebus.org.
iridethebus.org, and of course metroridersunion.org, or just come on down at 9 o'clock on Friday morning. You plan to have any meetings of the Metro Riders group?
We will. I think it is a little bit premature because we need to be able to distribute this newsletter and inform ordinary bus riders about the group. We, you know, so far people are hearing about us here on Free Radio, thankfully, and also in the Sentinel. We want to have the chance to do the leafleting, and then we'll announce the meetings through that channel. And hopefully it'll be sooner rather than later.
Maybe the Metro, the Good Time, some of the other fine alternative newspapers will also lend an ear because of their great interest in civil rights activities locally. Of course, you hear the vein of sarcasm in my voice, but, you know, one can always hope. And indeed, John Maurer and his free speech right through attorney Paul Sanford has gotten a column in the Metro about his fuck the pigs sign, which sounds pretty gross, pretty rude, and pretty raw. But what was even more raw, aside from a strong sign, was the fact that police cited this man for this sign. He faced fines, he faced harassment for criticizing our police department in a direct way, even though it was silent in the sign. That's coming up also, interestingly enough. I believe it's on Friday. It goes to trial at 10 a.m. in Department 1, for those who are interested. So you can dash over to the Metro to do the oral communications, and then dash over to court at 10 a.m. to support Paul Sanford and You'll be supporting John Maurer, a man who was a distributor of Street Spirit newspaper. And they've tried to drop the charges. And what the attorney, Paul Sanford, has said, you can drop the charges, but we want a ruling on whether you can tell someone with a sign that says, down with the police, or fuck the police, or I hate the Pope, that they can just come up and give you a ticket for it, even if you're doing nothing else that's criminal. They tried to link it with solicitation. Anyway, we have other guests in the studio who have been patiently waiting. They were supposed to be going on earlier. And I apologize to everybody for my usual confusion and failure to make the trains run on time. Mussolini, unfortunately, I'm not. But I'm working at it. I will start issuing orders immediately. Paul, is there anything you want to conclude with? Or anything updated that we've missed, since you really are here for the update? Anything specific that you want to bring up?
Just to say thank you for lending an ear. We have actually been sending out press releases to various groups. We haven't heard a thing from KZSC. We haven't heard a thing from Metro, Good Times, Register Pajaronian, San Jose Metro, San Jose Mercury News, their local bureau. The only media attention we've received so far is from the Sentinel, and they've been very good at paying attention to what we have to say, and from Free Radio. So we thank you for that interest.
Tip of the hat to Heather Berner, who I'm usually quite critical of, who did some pretty horrible reporting in the middle of the last decade around homeless and civil rights issues, but apparently has been trying to cover housing issues and this metro issue. She's done three stories on it, which brought you to my attention and hopefully has brought you to the attention of the community or some of the community here at Free Radio. Paul Marcelin Sampson, thanks again. If you want to reach Paul again, his website is www.metroridersunion.org. Also in development is iridethebus.org. And Paul, your phone number?
831-421-9031. Call anytime.
Hey, thank you, Paul. And if you want to come back next week for an update on what happened on Friday, I'd be most interested, and feel free to call in on Thursday night and to remind us between 6 and 8 that those who want to go down there are going to have a chance to, if they want to, exercise it.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks a lot, Paul. So, stay with us. We will be right with you, and next segment of our show, we'll be discussing the psychiatric scene here in Santa Cruz, or I should say the scene for human rights activists fighting psychiatric abuses here, and what's actually going on in Santa Cruz. That's the music of Mark Levy from a tape 15 years old now, but unfortunately still as current as today. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Our call-in number, in case I forgot to mention it, which I did, is 831-427-3772, 427-FRSC, 427-3772. You can call us from anywhere in the world if you got the money. You can also email to rnorths@hotmail.com. And for some reason that bounces back, try rnorths2@hotmail.com. I'll be fumbling around here trying to catch emails. We only have one studio line. I forgot to ask listeners to say, call in if you'd like to Paul. And actually, I didn't have a lot of time for a call, so maybe that was appropriate. But Paul is still in the studio, so if people have quick questions for him in the course of this next interview with the with our next two guests, you'll be able to sandwich that in, we hope. However, the subject now has to do with psychiatric abuses and the psychiatric survivor's response to those abuses. In the studio with me is Jane Kaiser. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
And the infamous John Stewart. Hello, John.
And hi.
Hi, John. So you guys, you are here in the studio after many years of experience with a psychiatric system, so-called mental health system. And I've talked in the air in the past, most recently in the last 6 months, about AB 1421, the so-called Needles on Wheels bill, which hasn't yet been instituted in Santa Cruz County, as I understand it, but there is a pilot project in Los Angeles. It was passed and signed by Governor Davis last fall, which makes it essentially loosen standards for involuntary outpatient commitment, which means instead of being found a danger to yourself, danger to others, or gravely disabled, and they can lock you up and observe you, and then more easily, forcibly medicate you on psych wards and such. Now they can require you to take medication outside psych wards on threat of being returned to psych wards, not on the basis of those three somewhat, not really stringent, but more stringent criteria. The new criteria are things like likely to deteriorate and has had a history of mental illness, hospitalizations in the last 2 years. We talked with Sally Zinman of the California National Mental Health Clients Network. I think I may have that right. On a couple of shows, and she's kind of continuing to work on this. She's noted the weakening of not just criteria for putting you on involuntary outpatient therapy once you're in the hospital or once they get you behind a locked ward, but even putting you around a locked ward in other states is becoming easier. What's happening in Santa Cruz? Jane, John, either of you can take this this issue if you want to run with it. Or maybe what? Well, yeah. Let me ask you that question initially, and then ask you to kind of give an exposition of where you want to go, what you want to put out to the community on this show.
This is Jane Kaiser, and I was just going to talk about PERC and how it's been around since about 1979. And
PERC is not a tranquilizer. What is PERC?
It's Psychiatric Inmates Rights Collective. And it's open to people who have been confined in a locked institution or anyone interested in promoting the rights of psychiatric inmates. We're kind of like a friends on the outside group. Most of our meetings are just for people who have experienced lockup in a psychiatric facility. And sometimes we do have open public meetings. Some of our goals are to educate the public about actual and potential abuses of the mental health system, and this 1421, AB 1421, is another actual abuse. We want to promote and protect any civil rights that are left, although I don't believe that really there are any. We tried for many years to go against the psychiatric institutional treatment of forced drugs, electroshock, and in the 90s there was a right to refuse psychiatric drugs if you were involuntarily committed, and I believe that's pretty much taken away at this point in time. And to focus on creating alternatives to the current mental health system in Santa Cruz County. The current mental health system is like the institutional treatment. They brought it to the community. They still lock people up in locked wards, warehousing the mentally ill, and treating them worse than as if they had committed a crime, which most of them have not. These drugs are thoroughly throughout all the institutions of prisons and care of the elderly, and also in
young people as well.
Young people. And the institutionalization was supposed to go along with detoxification. And instead of doing that, they made it so that these addictive and toxic drugs were the main form of treatment for anyone inside or outside a locked facility who had been labeled.
You know, interesting enough, Jane, we're talking to Jane Kaiser here, John Stewart's also in the studio. I just went to mindfreedom.org, www.mindfreedom.org. You ever been to that website, Jane?
I haven't used a computer, but I would suggest that website
along with others. It's interesting. There's a couple of, traditionally in the 70s, psychiatric survivors got together to fight forced shock, forced drugging, forced incarceration, forced psychosurgery, the abuses that were going on both in mental hospitals, and I guess in Santa Cruz, not just in mental hospitals, the Dominican Psych Ward, but in places like the 7th Avenue Center, previously known as Harbor Hills, where there's a real deterioration in the so-called standard of care, and essentially the removal of the autonomy of people in these situations because of the belief that they are somehow crazy, disturbed, defective, damaged. Does that cover some of that, Jane? What do you think? Am I right? Am I wrong? Am I on the wrong road here? What do you think?
Well, I can't think of
See, it's been my experience. I know that I haven't spent a lot of time visiting people in the 7th Avenue Center. I haven't spent a lot of time, I've been over to the psych wards when people have given calls concerned about their rights. And we've interviewed on this radio station George Cavallo, who I guess he's still the purported psychiatric, the mental health advisor, the rights counselor, the guy you go to for your so-called Reese hearings. That is to say, once they grab you and they've locked you up because they think you're a danger to yourself, danger to others, or gravely disabled, or in some of the other states where you just have to have a deteriorating condition. But here in California, that's still the standard about at least being locked up initially. You get an opportunity before they fill you up with psychosis-provoking medications. I know that sounds quite radical, but I'm more and more persuaded that that's the case based on the research you're going to hear next week from Robert Whitaker in his book Mad in America, and also from Independent Studies. Well, he got it from Independent Studies. Before they lock you up and forcibly medicate you with drugs that may be seriously bad side effects, you have a right to a so-called Reese hearing, which is not a hearing before a judge, but you want to tell us what that Reese hearing is? You say that and explain a bit about that.
Well, as it turned out in real life, they had these Reese hearings inside the unit, and oftentimes the inmate had been drugged on what they call emergency drugging. And so I've attended a lot of the Reese hearings inside the institutions, and sometimes the people are so out of it from the toxic drugs that they force upon people that they can't even raise their arms or barely speak. And it really immobilizes and damages nerves, organs, muscles. If these tranquilizers can take down elephants, they sure can take down people. And they're made from the residue of petroleum residue. Thorazine is one of the first pesticides, and they use that on people. There's a lot of similarities between pesticides and bugs and the tranquilizer, the psychiatric meds in humans. And I've been visiting, the first 7th Avenue was called Santa Cruz Care and Guidance, then it was called Harbor Hills, now it's called 7th Avenue, 99 beds, 3 adults to a bed, I mean, three adults to a bedroom.
Sounds interesting.
Six adults to one toilet. You line up for meals. It is a horrendous situation to put anyone in, much less somebody who's already a little unhappy with their life. I have a list of rights that you don't have once you become conserved, but I want to have John speak about what he'd like to say.
John Stewart, go ahead.
Yeah, my name is John Stewart. I'm an ex-psychiatric inmate. When I was in the psychiatric system, I was in a psychiatric prison against my will. I didn't get conserved. I was drugged heavily, turned into what all of us call a zombie. I was in a chemical straitjacket. I got a chemical lobotomy on Prolixin. Other people are on Haldol. Four inmates up in Atascadero one summer about 8 years ago died during a heat wave because Haldol prevents your body from perspiring, so you like boil inside. And the psychiatrist's solution was to offer cold showers. As a psychiatric ex-psychiatric inmate, I consider everyone who's held against their will to be an inmate in a psychiatric prison, essentially no different from the prison system itself with the sheriffs. They got psychiatric technicians, psychiatric aides, psychiatric nurses, and the treatment you get is as if you were an object. You get forced drugging, you get taken down, you get put in 4-point restraint, you get shot up with the most horrific psychiatric drugs. They have a new drug, new to me. They forced it on me. I accept it when they offer it. You know, I go when I'm first on a ward. The first thing I ask for is my writ of habeas corpus, which sets the tone. And whenever they ask me a question, I ask them where is my writ. They out at Dominican, they have a writ. You sign it and they fill it out and. Soon, within a day or so, the public defender comes out, and they don't want to go to court, so you get released, and depending on when you were incarcerated.
Now, John, that's different than a Reese hearing, right? The writ
right,
actually gets you to
right.
court. The Reese hearing just gets you before an administrator on the issue.
Right, a Reese hearing comes at the end of the 72-hour hold.
I thought the Reese hearing can come during a 72-hour hold if they want to medicate you during that period of time, and they're not using the so-called emergency medication loophole that Jane mentioned.
Well, you get drugged regardless on the emergency condition. You know, they don't wait for any other kind of hearing.
So there's no Reese hearing for anybody in the first 72 hours?
No,
that was my
I've never heard of one. Jane may have.
No, guess not. I guess I was wrong. These folks
yeah.
obviously know more about it than I do. Go ahead.
Yeah. So anyway, there's this new one that the Hemlock Society ought to know about. It's called Zyprexa. I overdosed on first two and then three later in a period of about 4 hours, and within 30 minutes I was in a blackout. Fortunately, I was at the VA hospital. They took me to emergency and pumped my stomach. I woke up in the ward. So if there's anyone out there from the Hemlock Society and are in great pain and want to terminate your misery, Zyprexa is a wonderful way to go.
And of course, the Hemlock Society is the right to voluntary euthanasia, right? The right to kill yourself if you want to die, as I understand.
Right.
Which is you're kind of.
I can't hear you over here, Robert.
Oh, that's your way of saying, John, as I understand it, that these are really life-threatening medications.
Oh yeah, definitely. They turn you into a zombie. It's a chemical lobotomy. Zyprexa causes your eyes to cicade and go around like that, and the scene jumps up and down and back and forth, and your skin is like plastic. And just three will turn you into a staggering, falling down thing. You know, that's just 30 milligrams. Anyway, I'm an ex-psychiatric inmate, ex. I was last in November. I got 5150 by my social worker, She saw me walking down the street and decided to call him to have the police pick me up.
5150, of course, is the welfare and institutions code that allows them to hold you for 72 hours if they think you're a danger to yourself, others, or gravely disabled. 5250 is for 14 days, and 5350 is, I guess, for 28 days or some such thing. Sorry, just a quick introductory note there, John.
Right. Well, what I want to read is from a publication in the that Robert's familiar with, Madness Network News. It lasted about 15 years. That publication mobilized the anti-psychiatry movement worldwide to the abuses. Our movement got so strong with the NAPA network against psychiatric assault up in Berkeley leading the way, modeled quite a bit on the tactics of the Black Panthers, you know. Almost every psychiatric ex-inmate group at that time was a collective, you know. And anyway, so in 1986 in Toronto, our people, I wasn't involved at the time, but our people shut down the American Psychiatric Association's annual convention up there. They sat in the lobby of the main decided to put money into what was became called the mental health client consumer movement. People accepted, and later psychiatric survivor, as if I survived. I didn't survive the system. I might as well have been murdered up there at Napa State Hospital. Anyway, they shut them down, and they started this mental, there was a schism in the movement, in the ex-inmate movement, and many of them took the path of getting the money, and they did some good things for a lot of the people. They got the Mental Health Client Action Network going here, and they got Howie the Harp got a nice building in downtown Oakland for the consumers and clients. Anyway, What I'd like to read is from that Madness Network News. It's a paraphrase and quotation. Psychiatry is not a field of healing, but a method of social control which produces physical illness and emotional misery, not health. The mental health system is an industry founded on the violence which psychiatrists practice with forced psychiatric treatment. The mental health system industry supports and is supported by racism, sexism, classism, ageism, and capitalism. And thank you, Robert, for having us on your show.
Sure. Now I want to talk to you some more, John. Interestingly enough, I learned some things about this, and we have an incoming caller. I'm going to answer that call in a moment, caller. In the 70s, one of the reasons when the psychiatric movement grew so strong is because apparently there were massive exposures of the psychiatric abuses in the Soviet Union. And in the middle of the Cold War, the U.S. government was made sort of conflicted and embarrassed by having, you know, reports out of the Soviet Union of psychiatric abuses and similar reports here in the United States. And they had to address address that issue. So for a brief time, psychiatric advocates, survivors, had a forum, according to Robert Whitaker. Hi, you're on Free Radio. Sorry, caller, try that again. We just missed your call. I'm sorry, I wanted to get that information out. Call back, 427-3772 is the number to call if you want to talk to our guests, Jane Kaiser and John Stewart of PERC, Psychiatric Inmates Rights Collective. Jane, how can people get in touch with PERC if they want to reach you off air?
They can call 475-7904. And for the international group, the Support Coalition International, I think you already gave their website, www.mindfreedom.org. They also have an 800 number, 1-877-MAD-PRIDE. And another organization that really has kept up with the psychiatric violence is Citizens Commission on Human Rights. They have a website, www.sitecrime.org. They also have a 800 number, 1-800-869. 2247, and from the Support Coalition of the Mind Freedom, you can get like information from Thomas Saws, his books Myths of Mental Illness and The Manufacturer of Madness, and also from the Citizens Commission on Human Rights. There's lots of books and magazines, and some of them are free, some of them cost, but there's a lot of information out there that is really intending to inform as well as to warn people about the mental health system that has some people believing that when people are sent to the mental health system, they will, quote, get the help they need. And I'm here to say they do not get the help they need.
We have an incoming call, Jane. Let's see, maybe a question or two for you. I know you have a display coming up in the library, too, I guess in November. The main library, we'll be talking about that in a moment. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Jane, John, Robert, and Paul in the background, listening astutely.
Hi, Jane, John, Paul. This is Coral. I had a question, well, first for Paul, but I'm gonna talk about the psychiatric part right now. Jane and John, I support your efforts, and I'm wondering if you have any information about how the durable power of attorney works if you are 5150, if you have already indicated to the hospital what's your medication that you will tolerate and what you won't tolerate. Does that actually work?
Hi. Well, many years ago when the Durable Power of Attorney for Healthcare first came in, a lot of us signed up. Protection and Advocacy helped us fill out the forms, and the one person that I know that filled out those forms, when she was readmitted to the Dominican, someone said, well, she's not a good case. Now, I don't know, you know, to take this on, honoring the DAPC. They didn't, there was somebody that was high up in mental health at the time that said he would not honor them. And I think you're going to have to check with the patient advocacy office to find out if there's ever been a DPAC that's been honored.
Would you say you need an attorney, an actual attorney, to force them, or?
I don't know. First things first, have they ever honored one? And if one hasn't been honored, you know, is there a? That's a good point, really. Since the 70s, we've been looking for a lawyer that would be on the side of the person being threatened, or in actuality getting the mental health treatment.
Okay.
What was your second question, Coral, for Paul, since he's here too?
Oh, I was thinking back of when I rode the bus more, and I've noticed in the years since I ride it occasionally, that the metro, the drivers are really sensitive to if a rider has some concern or complaint and speaks it out, that they stop the bus, they make them fill out a card, and everybody gets mad just because somebody says, oh, you should have, it's kind of an embarrassment. Before, they ignored the rider totally, and if you had an issue, like get the brake systems often, it causes the bus to lunge forward, and you might hit the window, you might fall forward, you might hurt yourself a little bit. If you express any complaint, then it's a pretty significant thing, and all the riders suffer for it.
Any comment on that, Paul?
Hello, Coral.
Hello.
I've been hearing a lot of things lately, actually just in the past week, about the approach to customer service on the buses, and witnessed a lot of people just asking general questions and you know, not getting answers or getting the cold shoulder. As far as filing complaints, I think the procedure now would be to deal with the head office and fill out forms there. But as far as just making it an operating complaint, you know, if you're on the bus and you're not satisfied with something, the bus is late or whatever, there are no longer comment cards. There's no longer a process for people to follow on the bus to register their opinions. And the union contract actually forbids Metro from following up on complaints that you make unless you provide daytime contact information and Metro can physically verify that you are who you are. The union will not allow pursuit of complaints. So it's just a bad situation all around, and I'm glad that you're raising this point.
Okay. Maybe I'll look you up on the your website.
Okay, we'd love to have you in the group.
Thanks.
Go ahead, Carl.
Oh, yeah, I just want to say bye to Jane and John.
Bye.
If John wants to say anything.
Everybody says bye. Hey, thanks, caller. Thanks, Carl.
Bye.
And phone lines are open, 427-3772. Give us a call if you want. It's 10:30 on Bathrop Spears Broadsides, Free Radio Santa Cruz's Norse extravaganza, where I blather on for 2.5 hours, luckily with the support from and some interesting information from a number of other guests here today. With us in the studio, Paul, Marcelin Sampson, Jane Kaiser, John Stewart. Jane and John concerned, probably all of them concerned with all these issues, I suspect, but Jane and John particularly here talking about issues of restoring rights to psychiatric survivors, Paul trying to restore rights to bus riders. Everybody's trying to restore rights. I'd like to see some rights restored rather than the last rights that we seem to be getting these days. Give a call if you got your own experiences, thoughts, questions, 427-3772. You can email rnorse@hotmail.com. I'm actually going to check that website in a moment. Looking at the mindfreedom.org website that you mentioned, Jane, I find that a strike, according to this website, just ended, a hunger strike, for Fast for Freedom and Mental Health. It ended on day 22, Saturday, 6th of September, 2003. You familiar with this one at all?
No.
Let me read a little bit about it. Give me your thoughts. Anyone who wants to can respond. Here is the announcement. Mickey Weinberg, hunger striker. We are 21 now. That is, it's day 21 of the hunger strike. We've hit maturity. Time to leave home. Time to assess what we've learned here at Hunger Strike Central. Time to regain our strength. Then, rested, strong, and better prepared, we will rise up again in far greater numbers to take on our adversaries. Before this Fast for Freedom and Mental Health began, its prospects were criticized on a number of counts. It was said it would insult folks who take prescribed drugs. And before we actually do this, why don't I describe what exactly this fast was, since perhaps people don't know. Here's the initial news release and fact sheet. On Saturday, August 16th, six psychiatric survivors from throughout the United States arrived in Pasadena, California, and began a hunger strike to press for human rights and choice in psychiatry. Their demand that the mental health industry produce even one study proving the common industry claim that mental illness is biologically based. The hunger strikers charge that the pharmaceutical industry and psychiatry are medicalizing an ever-widening spectrum of human emotion and behavior for financial gain and are willing to deceive the public while they too frequently humiliate and harm their clients. The government gives virtually total support to a quick-fix, pill-pushing model of mental health at the expense of alternative, less invasive ways of helping people in emotional distress, asserts David Oakes, hunger striker and executive director of Mind Freedom Support Coalition International. The hunger strikers are subsisting on a liquid-only diet until the American Psychiatric Association, the Surgeon General, and the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, I guess that's the group that got some of the money that you may have mentioned, John, before, adequately respond to seven challenges sent to them. The American Psychiatric Association has sent the Fast for Freedom a response. A team of 14 mental health academics and practitioners are reviewing the APA, American Psychiatric Association, response. One, Lauren Mosher, MD, former head of schizophrenia studies at the National Institute of Mental Health, said, "What we are dealing with here is fashion, politics, and money. I want no part of a psychiatry of oppression and social control. The targets of our fast have muddied the waters of mental health for far too long," said Mickey Weinberg, hunger striker and Mind Freedom board member. "It's time they come clean. They claim science is on their side. We're just saying, prove it." Mind Freedom Support Coalition is sponsoring this, and you get lots of information. If people want to check out this whole hunger strike and the issues involved around that, you can go to www.mindfreedom.org. Any thoughts, Jane, John, on this?
You don't have to have.
Any thoughts, Jane? It's not.
Hooray for Mind Freedom people and David Oakes. He's a real hero for a lot of us, and he's been at this a long time. He was with Madness Network News. He was a student at Harvard when he had some certain paranormal experiences which got him got him in trouble with the psychiatric system and busted him out of Harvard.
Hi, you're on Free Radio with John Stewart, Robert Norris, and all the rest of us.
Hi, Robert. This is Roxanne. I would really like to thank the people that are there and also the people that were involved in the hunger strike for doing what they're doing, because really who you're doing it for now are the children. They are now the targets of all the psychs. Every description of what would be childhood is now considered a disease. It's considered ADD or whatever, that children have natural energy, that they run around. And so, and children are being forced drugged too. They're being drugged. The principals at schools are demanding it. Your kid can't come here anymore. He's too disruptive. The teachers. And then children that are in the custody of CPS. You know, if they decide that your child's just too busy, you know, then you don't have any right to stop your child from being given Ritalin or something while they're in the care and custody of the county. And should you get your children back, you will have a very hard time getting them off these drugs, not just from the perspective of the withdrawal, but also from the perspective that you usually have oversight for a year or a year and a half. And so you have to keep doing what they tell you. So I really see, I'm sorry for what everyone's been through. I think it's horrible. But what you're doing, too, is protecting the next victims of not only the psych profession but the drug profession, because they can't talk back. Kids can't. So that's who they're aiming at now.
Yeah, I actually, when I talk to Robert Whitaker next week, his book mentions some of the massive amounts of profit that are being gained by the pharmaceutical companies by selling their medications, the same kind of insecticide-based shit, if you will, and the new so-called atypicals, the next generation of psychiatric drugs, like Soquil, and the one you mentioned, Zyprexa, other medications that are supposedly the great improvement, but actually these are all drugs that simply control behavior and have little to do with, in fact, they have little to do with helping people in terms of treating so-called mental illness, or even the behavioral syndrome, unless you believe that zombieing out people is a way to deal with an issue. But I know also, Roxanne, that you are, I'm hoping to play an interview with two people that you've been working hard to help, Stacy and Orlie Jones, and who are still separated from their four children, stolen from them from their motorhome back in April, and we had an interview with them, and we're hoping to get the update from you on that, as well as on some other subjects, which I think...
Well, probably isn't the time. You don't want me to do it now, do you?
I think, I think probably you're right. We should probably wait. I'm going to play the Stacy and Orlie Jones interview probably
right
in the next hour or so.
But I really am grateful for people that are doing this. To tell you the truth, 20 years ago, I ran an anti-Ritalin line, 25 years ago, mm-hmm. for the Church of Scientology. I wasn't a Scientologist, but I worked in an office where that was their donation to their church, mm-hmm. and I was hired to run it. And the side effects of so many drugs and the dangers have been known for so many years. All of the things that psychiatrists were saying, they were crazy, they weren't telling the truth and stuff, every one of those charges have actually been proven true. So it makes me sick when I still see children being given Ritalin. Anyway, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you. And stay tuned, and please call back with a longer report once we've gone through some of this.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks.
And thanks, Roxanne.
Yeah, Roxanne, how nice to hear you. I've always been wanting to speak to you personally. Many years ago, I found out that with one of my friends, her child was taken away when she refused to go for a so-called psychiatric evaluation, where she would lose her freedom for, 3 to 5 days. The CPS took her child because she refused, because she knew what was going to happen, and they adopted her child out. And this was not like a paranoid mother. She knew what they did to you in psychiatric institutions. And they kept telling her, little girl, your mother's sick. But every time her mother visited her, she looked just fine. But the system says, oh, that person is sick, meaning, mentally. And so there's very sad things that happen in with the children and the parents. And many times, if there's a split up and the one of the parents is labeled mentally ill, then of course then they take away custody from that parent and give it to the other. That happens very regularly. Not only do they drug children, they also electroshock children.
And they were performing lobotomies on children, according to Whitaker, too.
Well,
that, of course, was in the 50s, and you might say, oh, all those old bad days are gone.
The chemicals are lobotomies.
Sorry?
The chemicals are lobotomies.
Yeah, that's true, too, but I'm talking about the actual physical psychosurgery that was done, too. You know, I'm going to be talking with Robert Whitaker next week about alternate kinds of therapy, and we're not just talking about wild and crazy radical therapy from Kingsley Hall with R.D. Lang or something undertaken in the, you know, the deep woods with weird hippies running around chanting and, you know, engaging in nature ceremonies. I'm not saying those are bad things. Those are probably good things. But I'm talking about mainstream research done by just having people in an environment where they aren't encouraged to take drugs, but they are encouraged to, you know, they're given housing, they're given access to medical care, they're given emotional support, they're given someone to talk to, they're given counseling on different things. And the kind of success was much better than what happened with drugs. And these studies, there's one particular one from a group that was done by the head of mental health called Soteria in the 70s, have been suppressed because it is, I mean, one has to say, at least the conclusion of Whitaker, and I'm looking to get some of his critics so we don't just hear Robert Whitaker, the author of Mad in America, and simply his views, but other people's views, too, who maybe support the continued use of psychotropic drugs like E. Fuller Torrey, who's a big advocate for dealing with so-called mental illness. But I myself, and perhaps I'm, you know, I mean, I've had a long bias in this direction. I've always believed that drugs are just horrible. I'm talking about psychotropic drugs. I'm not talking about psychedelic drugs, by the way, though misuse of any drug is a bad idea. Drugs that were originally, you know, developed to tranquilize animals or to as insecticides, and then are suddenly that were used specifically for control purposes, or even as so-called brain-damaging drugs. That sounds like, you know, a critic talking about drugs in the psychiatric industry. But in fact, in the 40s and the 50s, they actually used the words brain-damaging as a positive because they felt that you had to damage the brain in order to cure the patient. I mean, this was actually this was specified in the psychiatric literature. I mean, you have a bizarre history of ranging back to the use of terror. I mean, we've got terrorists in the U.S. and we're on yellow alert and all that stuff, and we've lost our constitution. We're trying to get it back. But terror was considered to be an appropriate therapy, specifically use of terror in the 1700s, not by a bunch of kind of weird cranks, but by the medical establishment of that time, because they felt that distracted, according to Whitaker, I'm getting this from Whitaker and some of his secondary sources, that distracted the patient from her or his delusions. And it's just, to me, the kinds of results of drug therapy, forcing drugs on people or even pressuring people to take drugs, and the impact over the years produces all these negative side effects. But what positive results does it have? Well, they say if you go off your medication, you're going to go, you know, running around downtown looking weird and crazy and talking to yourself, and, you know, that's going to, you know, freak everybody out, and also it won't help you because you'll lose your housing and yak. These are not illegitimate concerns, but the question of is there really another way to proceed has never been really explored with a lot of research and a major push in America. Although it has been explored in some areas and been successful, what alternatives do people have? I mean, you've got mothers and parents and who say to the roommates of people who are on psychiatric medication, my son has to stay on the psychiatric medication because he'll lose his job if he doesn't. What do you say to people like that? And of course, every case will be different. But generically, what do you say? What can we offer as an alternative?
Well, There's written information on detoxifying from the psychiatric drugs. Dr. Richman wrote a book on psychiatric drugs, and you can find out pretty much everything you were afraid to know about them. There's side effects of sudden death and permanent irreversible brain damage that causes tardive dyskinesia, permanent irreversible brain damage.
But what about people
but
who...
As far as if you're on these drugs, I just think that somehow the community should push for a detoxification center. The detoxification programs were to come along with the deinstitutionalization, but the psychiatrists wanted their treatments to continue. So there never did come into being a detoxification center. I believe there is one in Clovis that has a good reputation. It's a pretty hot country. That's also only during the day. So, you know, and these books that you could find on Mind Freedom, they sell everything from pens that look like needles to the books.
But Jane, what do you say to? I mean, well, I'm looking for, you know, we're looking to the mothers of the National Institute for what's the mental health organization that's a mainline group that supports drugging.
Well, that's AMI, and they're pretty much stuck.
What's it called? The Association for National Association for the Mentally Ill, NAMI.
They're for the mentally ill, but
right.
they're.
But what do you tell them as
they're
an?
They're not for the mentally ill, really. The treatment.
What do you tell them as an alternative? You're saying, you know, yeah, you can detox. You can detox, but what do you do when a person is hearing voices, feeling persecuted, being deluded, you know, suffering from what others would regard as delusions? He thinks people are following him when they're not. She thinks, you know. What's the answer to? Obviously there's no one answer, but other than medicating people and stashing them away with chemical restraints or physical restraints, what do you propose to these families? What do you suggest? See, that's the alternative that has to be put out.
Robert.
Yeah.
There is no alternative at present. The only way that can ever be an alternative is through education of people to understand the dangers of psychiatry and psychiatric drugs and psychiatric assault. That's where we have to begin, and this is the beginning. We've been beginning every day trying to educate people to get them to understand. So if parents can understand what's going on with their child is not a biochemical problem in their brain, but perhaps paranormal experiences, you understand, like Shirley MacLaine has had all sorts of incredible paranormal experiences, and she's not locked up and never will be locked up. And there are people all over the world who have paranormal experiences that don't turn themselves into the psychiatrist, and none of their friends do. They listen to you talk about it, and you talk about your experiences and share them with people who understand that you've had a paranormal experience.
But certainly all paranormal, I mean, are you suggesting that those who say there are conditions under which people they get obsessive compulsive in the sense they continue to wash their hands, you know, 63 times a day? I don't know people like this specifically myself who are, I mean, I'm a little bit obsessive compulsive, but I'm not very clean. My fingernails are very dirty, but that's not the story. But the fact is, you know, I mean, there are people who engage in paranormal behavior, you know, who have paranormal experiences, and they're not treated as crazy. They may be treated as kooks, but they're not locked up. You only get treated as crazy if you start acting in a fashion that, and then this is a different standard entirely, has to do with social standards of appropriate behavior, but I'm talking about people who feel they are suffering and whose families feel they're suffering. I mean, are you saying that these things don't really exist? They should all be
No, I'm not saying they don't exist.
Right.
People do suffer when they see things and hear things that
right.
are scary as hell. It's terrifying, right. You understand. But the question is, what has our society, how have we been conditioned to respond to these things? So it's like the problem lies with society and social conditions and the massive, incredible power of the propaganda of the psychiatric system, the pharmaceutical psychiatric industry, to understand.
I don't disagree that the drugs are bad and wrong based upon all my research. My question is, they're intended to treat something that I think is, has some reality to it, and I don't know what the answer to this is. Let's see what this caller has to say.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, it's me again, Robert. I'm sorry. You probably hate it the days I listen.
No, that's fine. Go ahead.
I agree with the gentleman because I think that if anybody's different, we're afraid they're like Son of Sam. You know, we don't give people a chance to be different. And there are some people who want relief, who may choose drugs. But I think what these people are saying is, you know, it's being forced on them because they're different. There is a detox. I probably sound like I'm rah-rahing the Church of Scientology, but I want you to know that there is a detox center that the Church of Scientology has. And the government actually uses it, like when people come home from Vietnam, when they came home from the Gulf War, to detox them that had been... It's actually the only detox center they will use because it is so good.
Sounds kind of ominous to me, but go ahead. The government uses it, that's sort of a double-edged sword, but proceed.
Well, I mean, it does actually work. And I see what you're saying, but in other words, they won't pay their money to somewhere that doesn't work.
Well, they pay psychiatrists millions and billions, so I don't know. Maybe you're right. Go ahead, though.
Well, that's all I want to say is that I just think that there's no room for people to be different. Like the question you ask, you know, Johnny can't keep his job unless we drug him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a dear friend who's an artist who is supposed to be on heavy psychiatric drugs, but she can't paint when she's on them. And she chooses her creativity most often over peace of mind. Someday, I believe she's a great artist, actually. I own her artwork. And I believe that when she is dead, that she will be one of those artists like Van Gogh that someone will say, what a genius, what a genius. But it won't be until she's dead that people will stop locking her up, persecuting her, or whatever. She's not dangerous to anybody, but she's very different, and she does hear voices. And she has a lot of psychiatric issues. But I don't see how she does. I think her art and her creativity make the world a better place. And, you know, I've been through a lot of episodes with her. And it's okay with me. I don't know. I just, you know, that's what we're doing to the kids, back to the kids. They all got to be cookie-cutter kids, or we're going to drug them. So that's all.
Hey, thank you, Roxanne. And call in again if you'd like.
Yeah, we'd like to thank you, too, and I think we're... Really, in horror, you're really a heroic person to be able to contend with the society around you to help your friend.
Yeah, I think I would agree. I think support systems are really the key here. And I mean, I wish I were a more tolerant person in many ways. Here we have a caller, perhaps, who can teach me some lessons.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, good morning, Robert.
Hey there.
I wanted to welcome the guests to on. It's a very interesting show. And I also wanted to point out what Roxanne was saying and what Mr. Stewart was saying as well regarding social setting and standards set for the cookie-cutter type attitudes that most people have to fit into society. And I've got a couple of things I wanted to mention as well regarding how it is about the kids. I agree with that completely with you also, Roxanne. According to recent estimates, 3 to 4 million Americans under 18 take psychiatric drugs, and this number is a double from a decade ago. They're saying even toddlers are becoming patients. And another alarming fact that I wanted to point out as well is when you have the heads of, say, a Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, chief of child psychiatry saying, we don't know whether the right kids are getting the right meds. And to further go on to say, quote, if you've got a child who's got severe depression and a medication that I don't fully understand can alleviate that depression and allow the child to develop, I'm going to take that risk. The risks are abstract and the suffering is right in front of me. unquote. This is very powerful information coming from the chiefs of psychiatry that are prescribing medications to our children that are under 18 years old. And I have a lot of other things to say, which I'll probably talk about next Sunday with Mr. Whitaker. But I wanted to put that out to the rest of the group and take comments off the air.
We should say, Jennifer, that you're going to be one of the interviewers of Robert Whitaker on the air next Sunday when he comes on. He's the author of Mad in America, Bad Science, Bad Medicine, and The Enduring Mistreatment of the Mentally Ill. You can get that book in the library, or if it's not checked out, and it's also available from a bookshop. And so it's worth the buy, in my
opinion. I agree.
Hey, thank you, and call in with some more thoughts if you'd like.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you. Bye-bye. There are all kinds of, just looking at this book coming up, a review of it and a long interview was done in Street Spirit in June, and you can get that in the library. That's the homeless newspaper, and you can also get a copy from me or from Becky Johnson, who makes it available to homeless people to sell. We have an incoming call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, this is Coral again.
Hey, Coral.
I've got some ideas as far as support systems. There's all kinds of ways that people who are searching do find support, and basically it's not through this society, at least for me. I haven't found a very foolproof way of dealing with any kind of like ulterior perceptions other than through groups such as Earth-based Native American or people that use earth medicines, herbal remedies, and people that distribute these and read about them and have groups, or such as purification sweat lodges. A lot of these things are here in the United States. People can use them. It's probably not condoned by psychiatrists, but I know a few doctors that would recommend these kinds of things.
I'm wondering how other cultures treat so-called, quote, mentally ill people, where I know that this World Health Organization study, which I haven't read, but which I've seen referred to in Whitaker's book, there were two of them. One was in the 70s and one was in the 90s, which found that people that were diagnosed or labeled mentally ill in Colombia, Nigeria, and India recovered three times as fast and stayed, quote, well three times as long, or stayed well, period, as those in industrialized societies. And the only difference he could see that they were able to really pinpoint, and there were plenty of differences in the cultural backgrounds, but the main differences were that they weren't treated with these drugs, which are dopamine and serotonin inhibitors, which prompt the brain, according to physiological research in the last 20 years, to produce more of those receptors, and so make people more prone to, quote, psychotic behavior, or whatever that is. If you're looking at, this is Whitaker's view, and I don't know if my guests agree with it, because they don't agree. I think that there's a thing that's biologically based or chemically based called mental illness. But even if you use the psychiatrist's own definitions, you find that the use of these drugs produces this huge amount of increase in negative conditions in people who are essentially doomed to stay on high doses of these drugs, which simply control them. They don't resolve the problem. They make their life straitjackets and zombie-esque. And although I guess some people like them. I mean, we have to also say that if people want to use these drugs, I've got no objection to people being able to use drugs. I don't think people should be arrested for smoking marijuana, using LSD, or shooting heroin, frankly, provided they don't run around and, you know, rob stores and, you know, beat up people to do it, or involve minors in inappropriate ways.
Some people can't take MAO inhibitors, and I know St. John's wort's not good for some people. You can get that. You can buy it. There's other things that there's, such as SAM-E, that works for some people. Diet changes, but it's according. But you need support too. You need people to be around you when you have these hallucinations, as they say.
It's, to me, I mean, I've always had the idea that it's the society and the lack of the kind of love, care, personal involvement with each other that produces so many of the sicknesses we have.
And instant gratification, you know, that if you give somebody something, a pill that's got to take care of it, and they got to write down what happens.
It's not just instant gratification. It's a huge amount of money being made off the pushing of these pills. And I actually just want to, because I know our guests look like they maybe want to take off. I mean, they've been here for about an hour and a half now. The AMA, apparently, back in 1950, was receiving its five million from member dues and journal subscriptions, but only 2.6 million from drug company advertisements. But then, with a change in the law, which made it required that for any drugs, physicians have to issue prescriptions. Prior to 1950, apparently pharmacists could, or most of them were on the drugstore corners, except for the forbidden ones, the drugstore shelves. This changed within a decade to suddenly it leaped four times. Then suddenly, drug companies were spending $10 million. On the AMA, and all the negative reports about drugs that had been the case in the AMA began to disappear. And so you get this incredible corrupted influence, you get huge amounts of drug company money. I mean, there are these factors. It's not just the fact that we are an instant gratification society. Before our guests leave, I want to thank them. Carl, you got anything else you want to say? I'm sorry, I'm talking
Yeah, I can't remember the name of the medication, but that was on the list of one of the most money-making and ruthless attacks on the people using the medication. It was supposed to be basically for seizures, and it was given for all kinds of reasons, and people were... I don't have the information, but I got it off the internet how it affected so many people.
Sure. When you get more information, let us know, and thanks for calling in.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So while I make sure that my patients here are adequately medicated, we'll play a little music and say goodbye to—actually, we're not going to say goodbye. We're going to give them a moment to say goodbye themselves. But first, this.
Well, I don't know what I'm seeing here, but I know it's
was Jeff's Kitten, Phil Free. You can actually hear him today, perhaps downtown, singing in the heat outside Borders or thereabouts, flagrantly perhaps violating the law. This is if you stand within 10 feet of a building and you have a cap on the ground. That's criminal behavior, according to the Downtown Association and its little local government regime, the Gang of Seven on the city council. That's something we should change. But you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm Robert Norris. In the studio with me, we have a collection of ne'er-do-wells, Jane Kaiser and John Stewart of Psychiatric Inmates Rights Collective, mad as hell and not going to take anymore. And, of course, we have that character who's driving the Metro District batty, Paul, Marcel, and Sampson. They're all here, apparently. I've got nothing better to do than hang around the studio. But actually, I wanted to thank, I think the two of you are about to leave. You're welcome to stay for the show, but if you guys are about to kick off, is that the...
Yeah, pretty much. I wanted to say a few things that anyone on the drugs or that are interested in knowing more about the psychiatric drugs, go to your pharmacy and ask for an insert for whatever drug you're interested in, and then on that insert, that will tell you the different
side effects.
Yeah. Yes, some which are, as I mentioned before, sudden death.